I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. If you remember a bad teacher, you have an idea of what not to do. But if there is a teacher that you will always remember, what was it about him or her that made it remarkable? Did you feel especially seen and understood by that teacher? That your remarks were valuable in class? That you cared about the subject and know what you could and couldn't get away with? Now we ask someone who does it for a living, what makes a good teacher? Gina Borecka has been a professor of literature at the University of Connecticut Storrs for 26 years. She's the author or editor of countless books, both popular and academic. Her most recent one is It's Not That I'm Bitter. She's been a longtime contributor to this show, I think almost as long as we've been around. And soon we're going to ask you, as you listen, to tell us about a teacher you will always remember. Gina, I'm thinking about the first day. I'm thinking about how you, it doesn't even have to be the first day, but how you convince a room full of people that you are getting to know, a different age from you, that they will benefit from reading, say, I'm just picking something, Great Expectations by Charles Dickens. I could pick anything.
Absolutely. The first thing is, and actually I think the first day is a good place to start. Every class is different. You can't go in with one set of expectations, to go back to Dickens' line, that's actually going to work for every group. Every new class in 26 years, you know, aside from a sabbatical every 7 years for one semester, I've taught all of that time. And actually before that, when I was a graduate student, I taught for years. And it's always like a blind date. I mean, it's always going to be a different kind of chemistry. You've got somewhere between, I always have between, 20 and 40 students in a class. And you have, there's a lot of personality. There's a lot of stuff going on, flying between those individual sort of psyches and brains and emotional lives in that small room. It's always a small room. I taught very few big lectures. And that those students have to come together and understand that they have to trust their teacher. I never try to convince the student that the piece of literature I'm teaching them is going to be important, but that what they're going to learn in that classroom is going to be important.
So how do you do that? What do you say to them?
I come in with authority. That's the first thing I do. And one of the things that I tell my students who are going on to teach, and that's many of them, is that you cannot come in like Betty Boop and then try to turn into Judge Judy. You know, you cannot come in sort of cute and adorable, or you cannot come in like Mr. Rogers and think you're going to end up like Donald Trump, or God forbid, whatever authoritarian figure you're going to turn into. You have to come in as the person that they're going to invest their time. For most of our students, it's their money, their effort, and that they're going to trust you to make them come out with new ideas, new ways of putting together a way of looking at life, that they're going to come out with a new perspective, a new framework, new information.
Do you say that? I'm interested in whether you make the case to them before you start launching into the first book. Do you say those words?
No.
Do you say, listen, we're going to talk about something here? Or is the work the example, where you assume that they're going to intuit this, that they're going to get what you're talking about right now?
That's an excellent question. Now, I mean, literally on the first day, I walk into the room, I shut the door behind me. I always tell them that I expect them to be sitting down with their books open before I walk in. Nobody comes in after I do. And really, by the second class, they do. I pass around a sheet where they sign their names. I start calling on them the first day. And I have very few sort of gifts in the world. I can't sing. I can't dance. I learn everybody's name by the second week. I have very good short-term memory. My students are always astonished by that. But actually, by the fourth week, I expect them to know each other's names so that there's a real conversation that goes on. So they don't say, well, like he said. I expect them to say, like Frank said in the back, like Jessica, the blonde Jessica, because there'll be seven Jessicas in the room, you know, like Max, seven Maxes. And so that they're speaking to each other. So I go in and say, this is modern British literature. You are going to come in. We are going to read these seven books. You are never going to use the Spark Notes. You are never going to go on the computer.
Spark Notes are
cheat sheets. They're the Cliff Notes of today.
Cliff Notes, yeah.
Where they will summarize what's going on in a text, and that they will give you bad information, really bad information. It's by people who are trying to make money, you know, to buy drugs or to go to the track is what I tell them. It's people that you wouldn't ask for their advice on where to have lunch. Why would you ask for their advice on Hamlet? I mean, it's really, it's just easier to read the work. And I explain to them that I will call on them, that I expect them to be part of the conversation, that what goes on in a classroom is, as you and I have talked about before, different kinds of learning, that what goes on in a classroom is joining the grown-up conversation that's gone on for 2,000 years. And this is their entree into what the grown-ups have been talking about. So to be part of the conversation that the grown-ups are talking about, they need to do the reading. I expect them to be able to discuss these ideas. They have to have the notes about the pages that are flagged when they come in. They cannot make a comment. What I do explain to them is I will never ask them how they feel, because they think they're in English classes. So they're going to talk. I said, you can talk about how you feel. You bring a cup of coffee to my office. I'm there all the time. I take it no flavoring, you know, with a little bit of half and half. I will talk about, you know, until the cows come home. In this class, we talk about what you think. What you think is based on the text that you just read. You are not going to make an analytical point without ever referring back to the text. Every time you open your mouth in this class, you're going to have a page number to back yourself up. They're saying at the beginning, they don't think it'll be possible. By the third week, they're all doing it. And I teach for, you know, 90-minute classes, two-hour classes. And you can't believe that the time is up when it's over.
So this assumes, can you tell when someone hasn't read something?
Absolutely, in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. And so can everybody else. I say, I think we aren't really going to have much to discuss tonight, so we're just going to move on and we'll come back to you next week. And that's it. And
that student knows.
And they know. I mean, it's not even, I have at this point, as anybody who's taught for any length of time, I mean, I know the works inside out. And you can tell, and I just actually had a conversation with a great student who didn't do a particularly good job in class, and yet he was a great student. He was an interesting, complicated young man who had returned to school after years away. And I said, look, I could tell. I said, when you read the books, you were terrific. I said, when you didn't, it was all you asking those questions about, like, you know, there was an inscription on the tomb in chapter 3. Could you tell me what that was about? And I was like, actually, we could talk about that after. It means, you know, life goes quickly in Greek, and it refers back to why this young man had read poetry. But in fact, that has nothing to do with what we're discussing today. So we'll skip that. You know, this is not now I'm going to go into a 45-minute digression into this thing, which is going to take us nowhere.
Well, how useful is fear?
Oh, fear is incredibly useful. Not that intimidation isn't, but the students should be nervous that they will be, as again, I explained to my students, that they will be caught if they have not done what they're supposed to do, that they don't want to fake it. It's easier to do the work than not to do the work and pretend to do the work. And I explained to them that if for whatever reason, because everybody's life gets complex, if for some reason that night they have not completed the reading to the degree that they should have, that they should come up and explain to me before the class begins so that I don't call on them and embarrass them or myself in doing this. Uh-huh. And it gets really old after the second time that somebody has to come up and say, Professor Brecker, I haven't finished the reading for tonight. It's just easier to do the work.
I'm going to ask you a very hard question, and I don't want to put you on the spot. And you're going to get this when I ask you this question.
Yep.
I know teachers who have a kind of idea from the school that you are not to easily flunk people. Because this would be bad public relations for the school. You know, I mean, no teacher wants
ever
to flunk people.
Nobody.
You want things to get better. You want people to learn and care and all that stuff. But there are some kids who just aren't ready for a class emotionally or intellectually, whatever, for whatever reason. and they don't do the work. And there are some schools, I'm going to be honest, that, mm-hmm. that just say, I don't care, send them on, find a way, get them out of mm-hmm. there and on to the next class, because we don't want parents yelling at us all the time. So how do you handle it when somebody's not doing the work?
I handle it very differently from, let's say, the better souls than I have who teach high school or middle school mm-hmm. who really do have to wrestle with the parents in a different way. We can talk about that because they have a different kind of grace than I have. It's not something I could do. I student taught once in a high school, and it's the only time in my life I ever slept through meals. I would come home at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I would pass out. I was so tired. It was while I was living in Cambridge. I would miss the meal that was served at the college. It's the only time in my life I've ever done that because I was so tired. But what happens in my classes now is that there's a kind of a Darwinist sort of attrition that the ones who really aren't going to be able to do the work leave by the second week. And so we weed out the herd. And there are some kids who do stay. They end up, you know, they're either taking a pass-fail or they don't care what their grades are. And I will talk to them. I will say, you are not doing well in this class. You need to do other things, and you can make a decision about whether to withdraw, take it a different semester. But this is how this works. And they make their decisions. And for the most part, the kids who are really not going to be able to pass would have left by the time that we are negotiating the very end, because they understand. I have there's like a non-negotiable policy for the students that I have now who are teaching high schools. They are in a very difficult position because they are in a world where the parents are present and coming in and offering mitigating factors for
right. parents
every
are
kid.
Saying, I'm paying for this.
Right.
I love my kid.
Right.
Well, you know, can you cut him some slack?
Right.
He's got to play basketball or whatever
right.
it might be.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that I'm very grateful that I've never been put into that position. And I think that the really good parents know, and everybody knows that the really good parents know, that that's the worst thing you can do for your kid.
Here's what I want to know. Why is it that my tendency would be, I taught the art of the interview at mm-hmm. Yale, and I didn't do this, but thinking about you and the fact that, you know, for me it was the art of the interview. There was another entry into that subject. For you, and you know, maybe I should have done this, but for you, I think I would be tempted to make a case about why I picked Great Expectations by uh-huh. Charles Dickens. To get up in the class and to say, before you start reading, I want to tell you something. Do you ever think about your parents? Have you ever been embarrassed about your parents? You know, or your family members? Have you been ashamed of them in any sense that you didn't want to tell people about them? And you don't want to admit that you are, but when you think about it, you know, why would you be embarrassed? What does that say about you or in a relationship to what class you are in? Are you embarrassed about what class you're in? Do you want to be, and I don't mean school, I mean social class. Do you want to be in a higher class? Do you want people to think you're rich and smart? And that's what this story is about, examining your conscience about your, you know what I'm saying?
And absolutely. And that is what I do about when we get into every book. Absolutely. I mean, I misunderstood.
When does that come?
That happens like on the first day I give a lecture about why the period that we're studying. So if I'm teaching Victorian, it's about what's going on in the 1900s. For modernity, I'm talking about what are the changes, you know, Freud, Marx, everything that's changing then. But then before I do exactly what you're talking about. For every book, it offers a context. So if we start with, George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion, talk about, okay, here is a teacher of the language, somebody who could decide what class, it's what became My Fair Lady. So, you know, what are the expectations for women in these days? Has anything changed? Have the issues of class changed? What is the role of education here? If you could pass as somebody that's upper class, what's the difference between that? I often ask the students, if they were making a film of this, who would they cast? Why? And then they have to pick the passages that would then justify the casting that they choose.
Yeah.
I never, but again, that's very different from the feeling of like, you know, do you like this character? Don't you like
yes.
that character?
Yeah,
which is
yeah, yeah.
what they've learned early. And then what I think that the students like in the classes, and I think that's one of the things they remember, and it's certainly what I remember from my best teachers, which I'd love to talk about in high school, is that every book that we read in the semester builds on the book that came before it. So that what we start with Pygmalion then leads directly to Orlando by Virginia Woolf. So there's more about language and about gender. And then Virginia Woolf leads directly to Samuel Beckett, which leads directly to Elizabeth Bowen, which leads directly to Muriel Spark. So that every book, it's like nesting dolls, except that we start with the little one in the middle, and then the dolls get bigger and bigger and bigger.
And what do you think that's saying to these students? How are they growing and having a larger vision from each of these stages? How do you think about that?
I think that, it helps them make connections. So that they see
like wider vision?
The wider vision, but also the connections that there are, that all the stories are essentially following patterns, that the great stories of literature, because then we'll make connections to other books that they read. We'll say, yes, okay, this is going on, but, you know, for those of you who have taken the 19th century literature class, this is happening. Or for those of you who are coming from the sciences, this is what was going on when Darwin was writing Origin of the Species in 1859. Mm-hmm. You know, these are works of literature. Dickens is picking up on this. This stuff has disseminated into popular culture. This is what was happening when Freud was starting to write this stuff in Vienna, and ideas about, you know, women's sexuality were coming out, and you've got Miss Havisham who's stuck in this moment in Great Expectations. So that you've got it, if it's going well, you're crossing disciplines, and you're also then making the connection with what they were writers were writing 200 years ago, 50 years ago, and last week. And that, you know, good writing or good anything is news that stays news.
I think you can see why we're talking about what makes a good teacher. Gina Breck is here, a teacher, a professor for 26 years at the University of Connecticut Storrs. And if you have a teacher you remember, we'd like to hear from you at 203-776-9677. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with what makes teaching matter. Stay with us. Find out what we talk about on the show online anytime at WNPR.org. Right now, you can see delicious recipes for dinner, value wines, easy cocktails, and more. Click on programs at WNPR.org for the Faith Middleton Show. Gina Bereka is here, a professor at the University of Connecticut Storrs for 26 years. Also an author or editor of so many books, including It's Not That I'm Bitter, and a columnist for the Hartford Courant and Psychology Today, among other places. I asked Gina, who's been a teacher for a long time, obviously, what she thinks goes into making a good teacher. And you might have, as you're listening to this conversation, an idea of a teacher that you will always remember. There are reasons for this. Sometimes it's difficult sometimes to put this into words, to understand what happened in that experience that makes you remember a certain person. You know, what is it? Is it that they saw you? Is it that they made you excited about what you were going to learn? Did a person have a sense of humor and that seemed out of bounds in school, and so you saw a larger world through that person's eyes? What was it, if you can put it into words, that we'll help you as you call in and say what teacher this is. We're going to go to the phones in just 1 second. Gina, tell me about one teacher quickly. What was it about that person?
My first and second grade teacher, we had the same teacher, Mrs. Pruitt. And she made me feel, and this is how I try to make all my students feel, however many there are, she made me feel rare. She made me feel heard. And that's one of the reasons that I think learning somebody's name is important. It's not just, hey, you in the back. That we had to draw a big and little something. And everybody drew big and little houses, big and little dogs. I drew, because we had a picture book at home, different size planets. I filled the page with different size planets. And then I looked at everybody else's page and they just drawn one of each. And I really got scared, the way you get scared when you're a little kid and you think you did something wrong. And she said, that's really good, Gina. You know, you didn't do something like everybody else did. You did something different. And I felt this rush of gratitude towards her and permission. And I don't know, I swear to God that if that woman had not given me that permission in, what are you, in first or second grade? I was like six, seven, maybe six. I don't know what I'd be, I don't know where I'd be today. Mrs. Pruitt let me do that. She let me be original.
Oh, that's a good example.
And it was a gift that she gave me that I have tried to—
For the rest of your life?
For the rest of my life and tried to pass along. That's the thing that I try to pass along. I try to really hear what everybody says and respond directly to them. I don't know if I can every time. I did win, however, I'm going to brag, I did win UConn's highest teaching award. Many years ago, and that's I get a little medallion that I get to wear at graduation. So that's
and
my
you're wearing
award.
It now. No, so I will say quickly as we go to the phones that I came from a Catholic school into public school in fifth grade, and that's quite a transition because Catholic schools were, at least mine was, very strict. St. Peter's in Hartford is extremely strict. If an adult came into the room or a religious person, you leapt to your feet. It was a sign of respect when that person came in. So here I go into public school. I'm on my first day, and a person walks in the room. No, actually, I was called on. And if you were called on, you didn't sit at your desk and talk. You stood because it was a sign of respect to the teacher. So I get called on my first day. I've just been introduced to the class. I'm called on by Miss Durham, and I leap to my feet to give the answer. The whole class bursts out laughing. And Miss Durham says, "Everybody, I think this is a wonderful thing. I mean, she said, what a wonderful sign of respect. You know, you don't have to stand here." She said, "But what a great thing." She said, "You know, thank you so much for that." And then we went on. A, I knew enough. I didn't have to stand anymore. And B, she saved me from embarrassment in just the way she did that. Second part is, this is a teacher who got my sense of humor. And I just flourished under that gaze. You know, interesting, really, really interesting. This is the same theme. Yeah. Somebody sees you. And if they can find language to tell you, I see you, I value something that you're saying, what an impact that has. Mary Faith Middleton, welcome to our show on the best teachers. I'm with Gina Bereka. Go ahead, Mary.
Well, every year Intel gives a science award, $1 million broken up between elementary, middle, and high school. And the high school that won the award last year was Ossining as the best science program in the United States. The young man who was part of the trio that won this award, I went on the computer to see what his system was according to what he put onto the computer from his school. And the first two answered and said, well, they set the program up in the summer, and it's this, and it's that, and it's the other. And this other young man said, I wait a few weeks to see how my students learn. And when I find out the way they learn best, that's when I decide how I'm going to teach.
Oh, wow. That is the best story, Mary. Thank you
so much. This young man, by the way, has won other awards from teaching, from getting awards from universities, saying that someone applied and offered him as the best teacher they ever had. And he won a stipend from them for that. But I'm extremely proud of my son.
Oh, your son. I didn't understand that this was your son.
I didn't want to put it that way.
Wow, that is the best. Mary, thank you. And you know, I have to tell you, Mary, that it strikes me, I think there's something about love that is this way, that everybody has a language about love. And if you can find out the other person's language, the way they need to be loved, that is the great gift to them. It might not be your language, but if you figure out their language,
right,
then you can communicate the love they feel, not necessarily your interpretation of love. And really, that's the gift you want to give. That sounds like that's what he was doing in teaching. So, Gina... Mary, thank you so much, by the way.
You're welcome.
So, Gina, how hard is that in a class of 30, 40 people? Because everybody's got to be learning in different ways.
Absolutely. No, it really is. It's very hard. And you can't, you know, you can't nurture everybody in the same way or all the rest of it. You need to be able to have them sort of, I think of it almost like racehorses, going back to my early youth. You know, everybody's lined up at the track. It's a very educated person. You can tell I'm a very educated person. It's like they're at Belmont and the bell goes.
Wait a minute. Let me put down my cigar as I hear this. Go ahead.
But, you know, everybody, you want them to come out of the gate really at the same speed. You want them to be able to sort of keep up with each other. And so that if I see somebody is really falling behind, those are the students that I will ask, I'll send them an email. It's, you know, easier now. I don't have to pick them out after class or something. You know, you don't have to make it that obvious, but I will ask students to come to my office. I'll say, please come during office hours. And, you know, to let them know that I'm aware of the fact that somehow, again, they're learning differently. I expect students to talk in my class. I call on them. I expect them to speak. By the second week or so, you can already tell there are students. It's a long class. It's a seminar. You could tell that there are people very uncomfortable speaking. I will arrange with students who are uncomfortable speaking in class to write every week instead of to be called on. And then they have the option of putting their hands up in class if they want to contribute, but they need to come up with something so that there are, as Mary suggested, you have to work with different styles of learning, but you know, otherwise it's because it's a big class, they need to figure out how to make their style work with the class, or at least make sure that I know how I can help them figure out how to do well in this course. But it can't be tailored to the, you know, to them precisely. But it's like you said, the language of love. I mean, it really is. As much as it's teaching always has to have a boundary, I'm not their friend. And I think no good teacher would ever say, I'm your friend. You know, it's really about being their teacher.
I want to hear more about that. 203-776-9677, this idea of a teacher as a friend. 203-776-WNPR. If there is a teacher that you will always remember, we would love to hear a little bit about that story to try to get at why. What quality did that teacher have that made you feel seen, heard, made that class different, made you excited about learning? What is that quality? And if you are a teacher, you must be, you know, facing this every day. You know what this is. How do you get to kids? How do you stay fresh? How do you not become a duplicate, an avatar of yourself? Keep growing, keep changing. Howard Faith Middleton, welcome to the show with Gina Barreca. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. I'm honored to teach at the same school that Gina teaches at.
Oh, are you at UConn?
At UConn.
Okay, where are you, in Stores or?
In Stores,
okay.
Yeah.
Hi, Howard.
And
what department, Howard?
Civil engineering.
Okay, go ahead.
And I had a teacher in college. His name was Anthony Armanakis. He came into class the first day, and very imposing figure, about 6'6", and he says, my name is Armanakis, if you do not already know that. Two rules, you must be knit and don't chit. He was Greek.
And what did you think of that? What did you think of that?
Well, everyone was scared stiff of him. But when you went into his office, he was the nicest guy. A year or so later, let me, when he was going out of town, do one of his lectures. And got me into graduate school, and really I owe my whole career, I think, to him. Mm. And I had the honor several years after I was teaching at UConn, when I was inviting people to seminars, to bring him up to Stores from New York City and give a seminar and thank him personally for really changing my life.
What a thing that you got to thank the person who made such a difference in your life as a teacher. Howard, thank you so much for calling the show.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
That's a great story. And I think that the idea of being able, when I talk to a lot of my students, because I do spend a lot of time in my office. I'm in the basement next to the Coke machine in the bathrooms. It's like being in the worst place in a restaurant, you know, like a fast food area, like in a food court. But I have bowls of candy in my office and a refrigerator full of soft drinks, and it's really like a little refuge. And the students do come and sit and talk, and they come for the candy and they stay for the long conversations. And a lot of them will talk about the great teachers that they had in high school or middle school or elementary school. And I say, do you ever let them know? Do you ever, you know, does Mr. So-and-so know that you're telling me the story? Does Mrs. Smith know that? No. So send them an email. You will make their day. It's easier with your college professors once you're out in the real world, especially if you're an academic, to invite them back. I had the same privilege that Howard had. Mm-hmm. But when you're, I know from my students who've gone on to teach school that that's a rarer thing. And it's such a wonderful, again, gift, such a present to give somebody to say, I remember when in eighth grade you stood up for me, when you saved me in class. You know?
You're making me understand that just as every student for you as a teacher is an original work, every teacher for the students is the same. You know, I could go back to my high school days and tell you how the different, you know, personalities were. Mr. Zerbas, the math teacher, Mr. Boyle, the English teacher. You know, I could go on and on with these folks. There was a teacher when I was in high school whose style was, on the very first day, to come in. He would wait till everybody, you know, quite late, until everybody was in the room and chattering and whatnot. He would walk in and he would slam the door so hard that the walls would shake. Mm. And then he would go to the front behind his desk or podium or whatever it was. I can't remember. And we would be terrified. And you thought right away, oh, there is no fooling around in here. And so, you know, if we saw this in a book, we would say, is that a good idea? Is that the best way to get respect and attention from your students? No. Did it work? Absolutely. So
that is what I do. One of my students described me as Ilsa of the SS when I would come in. I mean, at the beginning, because you need to establish that. There is not a cell phone that rings. My students, I tell them that they have to turn off every electronic device. I said, if you have a pacemaker, if you have an ankle bracelet from your parole officer, that is off in my class. And that there was one, this, like last semester, there was one girl whose phone rang in the middle of class in her bag, and like, you know, 30 people turned around and went, ooh. Was laughing, but I thought good, because there were other people. I have other, you know, folks come up from other colleges and go, how do you get them to turn off their devices? Like, I don't have a problem with that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, it's the establishment of that it's simply not done. You create a culture in the classroom of respect, and that they respect each other, and of conviviality, that they really, that they do know that it's about a conversation, that everybody has a right to talk as long as you've got something smart to say. I mean, and the idea that what great teachers can do is to make you feel, again, significant when you've earned it. That it's not just about, you know, being loved for being a warm body, you know, that they get to get a commission on. I mean, we don't get a commission to teach. It's about being recognized when you do good work.
I want to get at whether you can feel it when something important has happened.
Oh,
people
yeah.
know this in public speaking. I remember once teaching the art of the interview at Yale, and I gave a particular class, and it was the first time I had taught this. And so I was searching my way, feeling my way. And in a particular class, a student who was so equally caring in my direction came up at the end of the class and said, I could see she was monitoring how I was doing. And she said, something really great happened in this class. She said, you're really on it now. You know, this is something. Mm. Here I am. I still remember her,
yeah.
You know, how mutually We were in this thing together, this experience together. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking about what makes a great teacher. If you remember a particular teacher, call and tell us that story. A little bit about why, if you can. But tell us the story of why that teacher made a difference. 203-776-9677. That's 203-776-WNPR. And we'll be right back. Faith Middleton. You can tweet us at FaithWNPR. That's FaithWNPR. Join the conversation with us on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. Thank you to you for listening and to our talented team, senior producer Lori Mack and producer Jonathan McNichol. Gina Barreca is with us. She has been a professor of literature at the University of Connecticut Storrs for 26 years, a longtime contributor on the show from the very beginning. She's the author or editor of countless books, both popular and academic. And her most recent popular book is It's Not That I'm Bitter. And we are talking about what it is that makes a good teacher. Gina, I know, I probably should say, has every 5 years come back, been invited to come back and to give a kind of senior lecture at Miss Porter's school. And I was asking her
Miss Porter's, it's another school.
Another school, okay. So, and I was asking her about, well, when you come back every 5 years to a school, what is it you say to these girls? And it's about education and about being girls. And what did they sing?
They sang, it was like the 10-year-olds, the entering students who were singing, "I am woman, hear me roar." And it was like I was in tears. I mean, yeah. I was laughing, but I was also absolutely in tears. But it's an interesting thing to see at whatever age. I mean, the teachers that these girls have, whatever, at the public schools, at the private schools. I've got students who are teaching in the magnet schools at Hartford. I have students who are teaching in all these places. And I know that these teachers will shape the lives of the students they're dealing with because they were such excellent students. When you were talking about giving the lecture at Yale, lecturing at Yale for the art of the interview, where stuff happens in the classroom, that when that kind of electricity, when that stuff transpires in a classroom, it's like electricity. It gets carried from one individual to another.
Well, we're talking about teachers, and administrators have such an important role because a school has a culture. Mm-hmm. I lectured at Ethel Walker and spent the day there in various classes and giving talks and to kind of the whole school at one point. The culture, the feeling of that place in Simsbury, Connecticut was so extraordinary that if I could have gotten a condominium and moved onto that campus, I would have done it. I thought this is the most exciting environment that I have been in a long time to see the feeling of the culture. That comes from somewhere.
Right.
That can't just happen. You know, it's not – there are classes where you have an extraordinary bunch of people mm-hmm. from year to year. There are – a whole school can be filled with an unusually high number of amazing kids. But there is a culture in the school, mm-hmm. and that place had it. And I think that's what you're talking about. Jim, Faith Middleton with Gina Barreca. Welcome to the show on teaching. What makes a great teacher? Go ahead, Jim.
I had the same experience that you did. I grew up through fifth grade in a Catholic school, uh-huh. and I basically knew how to follow other people's ideas. My parents moved us to Ridgefield in the 60s, so I'm going to high school in the early 70s, and there was a teacher there for social studies named Herb Dank, and I would love to find him, but if you Google Herb Dank, you get a lot of marijuana references, but you can't find that individual. But he taught everyone that we all had to have an idea and be able to defend it. And it was all about critical thinking. But also, So he was the person at that school that had a reading list for high school kids that included Black Like Me and the Chicago Story, Boss, and a number of other books that ended up running afoul of the local John Birch Society. So we also got to watch the courage of the man as he went through the semester and ultimately had to resign. So I went on to become an attorney, and I got to think that part of it was the paradigm shift from being a pretty obedient Catholic schoolboy to being a person that wanted to make sure that everything I believed made sense to me.
What a great story. Thank you so much, Jim.
That's an inspiration right there. That's a reason that should be on like a teaching website. That should be on the NEAG school, you know, UConn teaching website about what inspires kids to go on and how you never know when you're going to make a difference. But the teacher, I think that kids know, students know at any age, actually, students know when they're being handed a bill of goods or when a teacher has integrity.
And, or passion.
Or passion, too. Right. Yeah. And so that teacher was willing to go to the wall to defend the books that he had chosen, even if a local, you know, society on whatever side decides that you can't teach this. And, you know, my husband does the Bedford Introduction to Literature, Michael,
yeah,
and his book is used in over 1,000 colleges and universities. And the selections are often, Michael Meyer, and they're often challenged. School districts will say, oh, there are things that are sexual in here, or they're gay and lesbian writers, or they're, you know, there's stuff that they find too dangerous for ideas. And that the teachers then who have chosen the book have to explain that ideas are not dangerous.
The publisher?
They have to explain to the school boards or the families who are
who
protesting.
Who does that? The teachers?
The teachers who chose it or the schools who chose the book to teach.
And do they win?
Sometimes, but sometimes it actually, you know, makes local news and that they have to make a defense of what you teach, but you should be able to defend what you teach.
Yeah. Well, you know, here we are at passion and how that affects kids when they hear your passion. We assume in saying that the passion somebody's going to have for something is in line with our views or the views you grew up with and so that you've adopted. And, you know, sometimes that's not the case. I remember sitting in a class and arguing with my English professor because the professor said the life of the author, what happened in that author's life, doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. That author's psychology doesn't matter. And I remember sitting, not thinking that I was particularly, you know, had even a view about this. And I thought, that makes no sense to me. Of course that would matter. And I raise my hand and I say, and we had a kind of fight in class about this. Now I understand, because there are so many authors of great works whose lives I don't admire. Mm-hmm. But yet here is this work of art. I still struggle with what that means, but I have to admit it's true.
And did you feel that the teacher, the professor was giving you a run for your money? Did you feel like you were engaged in a real way?
But at the end of the conversation, I didn't feel as if, I've changed my mind. I thought we both left with our honor intact and our opinions intact, and there you go. I was meant to stop now, be quiet. You know, because the teacher was in charge. Katie Faith Middleton, welcome to the show with Gina Barreca. Go ahead.
There are so many teachers who have inspired me over the years.
Lucky you.
I know. It's almost to the point where I can't even name them, but I would like to name them. There are three UConn professors, actually, at Storrs, who inspired me to ultimately pursue the career I have now, and then one high school teacher. But the thing that always struck me about them, because I did pursue an English and journalism degree, was that, and when I was graduating, it was very, very bad economy, and there was a lot of uncertainty what was going to happen to us as graduates, and they never really let that cut them down. It was something they acknowledged, but it was always sort of it doesn't really matter as long as you're passionate about what you're doing. And I always admired that the things they chose to teach us. And one professor I had was Sydney Plum, and she always chose to teach us works that were a little bit different and weren't necessarily I took a Native American literature class with her, and she was just so passionate about what she was teaching that you got something from it even if you weren't sure how this was going to really benefit you in the long term for a career. I just always admired that, that they, even in the face of what seemed like adversity, they were always willing to be there and make sure that you understood how passionate they were about what they were teaching.
Got it. Thank you so much for your comments. Really appreciate it. Katie, Faith Middleton with Gina Barreca. Katie, are you there? Oh, right. I'm sorry. I lost. Oh, that was
that
Katie.
Was Katie.
I'm sorry. I thought it was another Katie. Linda, Faith Middleton with Gina Barreca. Go ahead.
Hi. My name's Linda. I'm from Hamden.
Yeah.
There was an instructor in high school who was really wonderful. He was my biology teacher, and what I liked about him was that he treated everyone the same. I encountered two instructors, one in grammar school and one in high school, who were just terrible. When I was in grammar school in seventh grade, the instructor went around the class asking all of us what we wanted to become. And I said, I want to be a scientist. And he said, you? And he started laughing and had the whole class laughing at me.
Mm.
I had a session room teacher in high school, the same high school where I encountered this very nice teacher. Mr. Nave was his name. He was wonderful. I read his obituary a few years later, and I felt sad that I never went back and said something to him about his kindness. But the session room teacher, who was an old normal school instructor, if you yawned in class or giggled or anything like that, she'd glare you down. And at a point, she started referring to me as the meatball, which was my ethnic group, Italian. But at any rate, in spite of some of the experiences, because of Mr. Nave, I did get a bachelor's degree in biology and a master's in environmental science, plus a variety of certificates in various areas like environmental engineering and industrial hygiene. But that was the good and the bad.
Yeah.
And I don't know where these people came from, and you wonder what's wrong with them.
Well, you know, I guess it's like any profession, right? So so they're good and bad.
But we entrust our children to these people. So, I mean, I really understand that, you know, we need to guard against the bad ones that are different from, let's say, if you're bad and working retail, you know, you might lose a sale or you go home with a pair of socks that don't fit. But you have somebody who actually gives you ethnic slurs when you're 8 years old or makes you feel like you're stupid. And when you're still, your personality and your idea of yourself is being formed, that has a greater sense of lasting, sort of damage that you can carry with you. And it's great you didn't.
Well, this is a great point that you're making, Gina, about this. I remember my niece describing of the behavior of a particular teacher, and I was beside myself over what to do. And I ask myself now, why? Because you're part of life. You're going to run into people who are, expansive and beautiful and have it together. You're going to run into people who aren't so great. So you would expect that in school, kids are going to come up against both. It's what you're talking about. It's that in school, it's not just what parents do. These, you know, teachers have such an influence on these kids that it's incredible. Despite that, you know, in the end, parents are the most important.
Right.
It's still really important to think that a teacher is working for the good or the bad of your child.
Because
it's just almost, it's either the most joyous thing or intolerable.
Because there is an imprint. They leave a lasting imprint, whether that is, something really positive or whether it's a wheel that's left by a whip. And it was the Canterbury School. I finally remembered where it was that they have me back every 5 years.
Great school.
The girls of Canterbury,
great
the
school.
Women of Canterbury, not the girls, the women of Canterbury have me back.
Gina Barreca, thank you so much. I can see what a teacher you are. Thank you so much for being with us. 26 years at the University of Connecticut Storrs teaching literature and a longtime contributor on the show almost from the beginning. As always, this show is about the richness of life. Find the books, people, great recipes, value wines, and cocktails we feature right now at WNPR.org. Click on programs. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.